was correct upon and ran away with him.
John Akpata, I'm a spoken word artist from Ottawa, Ontario. You are listening to CITR 101.9, the best community radio on the West Coast.
And they got a lot of great distant cheers, at the government center. They gotta make the secretaries feel better when they put those stamps on all those letters. We gotta rock the rock the rock and roll stop tonight, at the government center. Make the secretaries feel better when they put the stamps on the letters.
Today is Friday, the 31st of January. I'm Max Nominacher.
And I'm Christine. You're listening to 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 6 minutes past five, and time for a full hour of independent campus, local and international news. Today's top stories and segments are Christine Kim's interview with Tiffany Minter and Miranda Massey, the coordinators of this Wednesday's Suicide Awareness Day, as well as a clip from a lecture by Dr. Michael Kimmel, a sociologist, pundit, and author of the critically acclaimed book Guyland, who spoke at UBC on Wednesday as part of the Sexual Assault Awareness Month. He discussed issues of masculinity on university campus.
We also have today's hot topic in their... We also have today's In Their Shoes. In today's episode, Morme Zhang asks UBC students what the first issue would address... what the first issue they would address would be if they were elected president of the AMS. And Max Nominaker's interview with SFU's professor Andrew Feinberg about how technology such as MOOCs changes education.
But first, your headlines for today. In campus news, the UBC Board of Governors approved the appointment of Michael White to the position of Associate Vice President, Campus and Community Planning. White is a former senior planner of the City of Vancouver and senior planning manager of Abu Dhabi. In his new position, White will work closely with the executive in overseeing the campus planning and design portfolio, the consultation portfolio, and the sustainability and engineering portfolio for both of UBC's campuses.
At roughly 3 p.m. this Wednesday, a water main on Marine Drive burst, spilling water into the entrance and lobby area of the Museum of Anthropology. Patrons were promptly escorted out of the building while crews attempted to halt the water flow. According to a recent statement, the damage was successfully contained to the lobby and entrance areas. Yesterday, the museum once again opened for business, its collections thankfully spared from any water damage. Also, yesterday, the head building saw the outbreak of a small fire during a practice demonstration. Luckily, no one was injured.
Finally, the AMS election has come to a close as of 5 p.m. today. The results of the election will be announced at the gallery launch and pub later tonight at 6 p.m.
In local news, the UBC School of Law is urging that the Law Society of BC, quote, consider the harmful effects that effectively excluding LGBTQ people from the Trinity Western University's proposed law school would have on their law students, lawyers, and citizens of BC, end quote. The statement goes on to take issue with Trinity Western's community covenant, the signing of which is required for the admission to the university. The covenant asks that members voluntarily abstain from sexual intimacy that violates the sacredness of marriage between a man and a woman. Trinity Western University reserves the right to discipline and dismiss students and employees who breach the agreement.
Professor Margaret Young of UBC has openly criticized Trinity Western, stating, "We encourage the Law Society to look fully at the conflict between TVU's community covenant agreement and a lawyer's obligation of non-discrimination. As a result of the community covenant agreement, lawyers employed by the TWU as staff or faculty may be forced to choose between enforcing the TWU's covenant agreement and complying with BC's Code of Professional Conduct, which requires non-discrimination." For its part, TWU President Bob Kuhn has said that while the university does have strong religious roots and is committed to fully and comprehensively teaching all aspects of law, including human rights, ethics, and professionalism.
In national news, Justin Trudeau, as part of his radical moves towards Senate reform, announced on Wednesday that he had expelled every single Liberal member of the upper house from his caucus. The former Liberal Party members of the upper house will continue in their roles, only now they will be recognized officially as independents. Trudeau challenged Prime Minister Stephen Harper to match his action, saying, quote, "As the majority party in the Senate, immediate and comprehensive change is in conservative hands," end quote, adding that this was calling on the Prime Minister to do the right thing.
In the question period, Prime Minister Stephen Harper mocked Trudeau's Senate announcement, saying, quote, "I gather the change announced by the leader today is that unelected Liberal senators will become unelected senators who happen to be Liberal." Harper went on to say that Canadians are not looking for a better unelected Senate. Canadians believe for the Senate to be meaningful in the 21st century. It must be elected.
Those are your UBC campus and local and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but please stay tuned.
Vancouver is gearing up for the 27th annual Bob Marley Birthday Bash. Once again, the birthday bash will be held on Saturday, February 8th at the Grandview Legion Hall, 2205 Commercial Drive. Artists performing this year are Geronimo, Zuki Joseph, Macronix, Rasta Rubin, and the Selassie I Power Band, featuring Fred Locke Sasher and other special guests, Ultra Flex Crew, Purple Soul Band, and MCs George Barrett and Louis Sutherland. Jamaican food and refreshments will be on sale. Advanced tickets available at Zulu, High Life, and Rhythm and Spice.
Wow, so smooth. Such art. Must have, it's the
new format of Discord. Join us at the Astoria on Friday, January 31st, as that magazine from CITR celebrates the launch of a brand new redesign with some great local bands including Cult Babies, Catlow, War Baby, Hollow Moon, and more.
There was this dog in my neighborhood that it takes
Admission is $5 before 10 p.m., so be sure to get there early to check out our new 72-page art mag, cool prizes, and more.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Christine Kim's interview with Tiffany Minta and Miranda Massey, the coordinators of the Suicide Awareness Day, held this Wednesday.
The Student Housing and Hospitality Services Department. Additionally, I co-chair the Suicide Awareness Committee, and our big campaign is Suicide Awareness Day.
And I'm Miranda Massey. I'm the Health Promotions Coordinator for Human Resources here at UBC, and I also assist TIP as the co-chair for the Suicide Awareness Committee.
The first question that I have for you guys is, what is Suicide Awareness Day, and why is it so important to host here at UBC?
So Suicide Awareness Day is a one-day campaign that the Suicide Awareness Committee has annually, and its goal is to encourage a caring campus community and to spread the message of reaching out for support. Additionally, it's about raising awareness of warning signs for suicide and the campus resources we have available to folks who may need that support.
Yeah, I think it's just it's a really important initiative because it demonstrates to the whole campus community, students, staff, and faculty, that there are resources out there and that reaching out for either yourself or for someone else that you're concerned about is something that's possible and something that's encouraged at UBC.
How have UBC students and staff made it possible for this day to happen? So how have they contributed thus far, and what do we hope to see today, I guess?
So the committee includes both faculty, students, and staff, and the committee does a lot of work planning for this day to happen. And so in that respect, the faculty members and staff members and students that sit on that committee do a lot of work to ensure that this day is successful. Additionally, we require about 40 volunteers to make the day possible. They staff booths and also are part of street teams that walk around in highly populated areas of campus to ensure that we're spreading the message and passing it along.
I also think that throughout the year we are able to get some feedback from a lot of different student staff that we have, volunteers and staff and faculty, through their various projects and through the work that they do, that helps inform sort of our goals and the methods that we use to get the message out and really highlight the day itself and the work of the committee on campus.
All right, so on the topic of campaigning and getting the word out about the Suicide Awareness Day, what are the main, I guess, channels that you guys have used to get the word out about this day?
I would start with a broadcast email that we were able to send out through UBC Communications. Typically, broadcast emails go out to the entire campus community and with a message as important as suicide awareness. Even if we're reaching one person with that email, that's deemed as important enough to send that message out to the entire campus community. Additionally, we're using some social media outreach as well. So at HealthyUBC is the Twitter handle that has served as the main Twitter page for our campaign. And so folks that are engaged with UBC over social media are able to see those tweets. And a lot of folks across campus have been retweeting the information that we've put out there, just to ensure that we're reaching all the different channels there.
We also have done a lot of work on our website over the last few years. We're using the thrive.ubc.ca website, which is used for our mental health awareness campaign, UBC Thrive, in the fall, but we thought it was a really great link because we are talking about mental health and trying to build that positive mental health on campus. So we've had a great communications team that has helped us really focus the website, make our messaging clear for what this day is all about, and also to highlight all of those resources that are out there. There's also a myths and facts quiz that's on the website that anyone can go on and take that myths and facts quiz about suicide and suicide prevention. And so that's a really nice resource to have up there as well.
And the final piece that I'll add is that we have a poster campaign that goes on year-round that messages about suicide and sharing some of the facts and information we know about suicide based on our work with the faculty expert on our committee to share that message year-round. And so those posters are up in our residence halls. They're up in the student union building and other places on campus that have high traffic, that students are able to tap into that message in a passive way as well.
The local health and safety committees actually as well, made up of staff and faculty across campus, have been very helpful with that, and they help us distribute those posters as well so that we make sure they get into the workplaces and lunchrooms for all of our staff and faculty as well.
What are some of the stigmas, do you think, that are associated with this and seeing that we do have to get the message out? What's some of the myths, I guess, that you guys could say that are pretty detrimental to like a sensitive issue like this?
I would say one of the pieces is that there is a myth that only experts are able to address the subjects of suicide. And that is a myth because really with the prevalence of suicide in our society, it should be everyone's effort to prevent it. And UBC provides QPR, which is a suicide prevention training, question, persuade, refer, that enables anyone who is interested in preventing suicide to be trained on how to do that. And so it's a myth that only experts have the ability to prevent suicide. In fact, suicide is one of the most preventable methods of death there is. And anyone who is interested can find out the information that they need to successfully prevent it.
I also think one of the other myths is that we shouldn't talk about it, and that we might put someone in danger, or it might be harmful to someone who could potentially be having thoughts about suicide if we talk about it with that person. So that's one of the things that QPR teaches, and that's what we're really trying to do with some of our messaging, is to encourage people to reach out to someone if they're concerned about them, and to ask them how they're feeling, to ask them if this is something that they're thinking about, because it's not actually harmful to ask someone whether or not they're having thoughts about suicide. And in the end, it can really help them to talk about it and to have the support to then seek help for themselves.
Is this QPR thing like a session that happens twice a year, or is it something that people have to sign up for, and is it off campus, or is it just tell me a little bit more about that.
So there's a QPR committee who trains trainers to be able, in the UBC campus community, to be able to offer the training, typically with students. A variety of training sessions are offered over the course of the year, and typically advertised on Careers Online, where students can sign up to participate in that training. A lot of our peer support groups, so the residence advisors, the peer helpers in the different UBC student communities, are trained in QPR as part of their general training that they receive for their roles. And so it's offered multiple times over the course of the year. And if a student was interested in receiving QPR training, they would only need to reach out to a staff member that they knew in either Residence Life, in the Center for Student Involvement and Careers, or any other campus group that they're involved with to find out how they can receive that training.
And on the staff and faculty side, through Health, Wellbeing and Benefits and the Healthy UBC Initiatives Program, typically we offer 3 to 4 QPR general training sessions for staff and faculty throughout the year, as well as we offer them 4 individual departments and units who might be interested in having everyone in their team take the training together. Then that can be arranged as well through our office.
Is there one particular thing that you hope UBC students will get out of today?
I think the two-word message we are putting across is reach out. And so if students could take that message and have that message resonate with them and recognize that reaching out is not just about reaching out for support for yourself if you need it. It's also about reaching out to support others that may need that support. And there are a variety of different ways that you can do that. One of them being visiting our booths and finding out how you can sign up for a QPR training session and to become a certified gatekeeper and have the tools that you need to provide that support. Equally, also reaching out to the variety of different resources we have on campus to support individuals, both who need the support for themselves and also who are wanting to support others around them. So if there are 2 words we want people to take away, it's reach out.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're really trying to combat the stigma that exists around suicide, and by carrying that message of reach out and promoting that across campus, we really want to send that message that reaching out is not a sign of weakness, reaching out is a sign of strength, whether it is for yourself or someone you're concerned about.
So in the process of like hosting this event and organizing it and all that stuff, for both of you guys, what's one thing that you would say that really resonated with you or that you learned that you didn't know before?
I have been so floored by how willing individuals on campus are to talk about this and also to support it. Campus partners that we've reached out to have posters in their area or to have buttons in their area or to distribute pens in their areas have all been willing to do so. The volume of volunteers we receive when we put the recruitment call out there has also been absolutely incredible. And so I would say that the takeaway for me is that the campus cares and everyone is looking for an opportunity to have the conversation. And really that's the message we want to put out there, is that we do care. And so in any capacity that you're able to provide support or if you want to reach out, know that there are a variety of different people around who are eager to provide that support to you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. This is the 3rd year that I've been a part of this committee, and I think seeing the Awareness Day and the campaign evolve over the last 3 years has really been remarkable. And the fact that this year, I would say out of all of the years that I've participated, the response that we've had from the campus community, from student and staff volunteers, from departments and units, from student groups, is really tremendous, and I think that does it. It shows us that people are willing to talk about this and that they want to contribute to making UBC that caring campus community. And I'd just like to say thank you to all of our committee members and all of our volunteers for helping us make this campaign so memorable and so widespread.
All right, thank you guys.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
Vancouver is gearing up for the 27th annual Bob Marley Birthday Bash. Once again, the Birthday Bash will be held on Saturday, February 8th at the Grandview Legion Hall, 2205 Commercial Drive. Artists performing this year are Geronimo, Zuki Joseph, Macronix, Rasta Rubin and the Selassie I Power Band, featuring Fred Locke Sasher and other special guests, Ultra Flex Crew, Purple Soul Band, and MCs George Barrett and Louis Sutherland. Jamaican food and refreshments will be on sale. Advance tickets available at Zulu, High Life, and Rhythm and Spice.
Studying abroad looks great on your resume and opens doors for exciting career paths. Don't miss the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Wednesday, February 26th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Convention Center, East Ballroom. Admission is free. Come early at 2 p.m. to listen to our guest seminar on how to access over $100 million worth of scholarships for your studies. Check the website on studyandgoabroad.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Next up on today's program, we have today's episode of In Their Shoes. Today's topic ties in with the AMS election, which happened this week. I hope you all voted. Mormay asks UBC students what the first issue they would address would be if they were elected UBC AMS Prez.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining. That's what friends are for.
Right now we will be playing a portion of Dr. Michael Kimmel, who spoke at UBC on Wednesday as part of the Sexual Assault Awareness Month. He discussed issues of masculinity on university campus. CIT contributor Josh Gabardoyon attended. Here's a clip from the final 10 minutes of his lecture.
That we're clear that as women's lives have changed, there are some issues for men that we have to deal with. And one of them is, remember that very, I'm now going to talk just for a couple of minutes about what's in it for us, why we should do this. You remember that first rule, that first area of change in women's lives, that women made gender visible? Well, I want you to think for a minute about how that works for men. Because when I say the word gender, what gender do you think of? Women. Most men don't think about gender. Most men don't think of, I mean, look at the, you know, here's a lecture called Guyland, by a guy, and it's about men, and look at the audience. Most men don't think gender has anything to do with us. Most men don't know that gender is as important to us as women understand it is to them. And this is political. This is our first moment about how we start to think about this, how we bring this conversation, how we start this conversation. Most of us don't know that gender is important to us. And as I said, this is political. Let me tell you my own story about this. This is a story that takes place 30 years ago, and it could not possibly happen today for reasons that would be obvious to you when I tell you. But 30 years ago, when I was in graduate school, a bunch of us got together, and you know how graduate students get, you know, like so excited about all these new ideas. And a bunch of us were sitting around one day, and somebody said, you know, there's an explosion of writing and thinking in feminist theory, but there's no courses yet. So we did what graduate students typically do. We said, let's have a study group. We'll get together once a week. We'll talk. We'll read some texts. We'll talk about it. We'll have a potluck dinner. So each week, 11 women and me got together. And we would read some texts. feminist theory and talk about it. During one of our meetings, I witnessed a conversation between two women that changed everything for me. One of the women was white, and one was black. The white woman said, this is the part that's going to sound really anachronistic 30 years later, said, all women have the same experience as women. All women face the same oppression as women, and therefore, women have a kind of intuitive solidarity or sisterhood. And the black woman said, I'm not so sure. Let me ask you a question. So the black woman says to the white woman, when you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror, what do you see? And the white woman said, I see a woman. And the black woman said, you see, that's the problem for me. Because when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, she said, I see a black woman. To me, race is visible. But to you, race is invisible. You don't see it. And then she said something really startling. She said, that's how privilege works. Privilege is invisible to those who have it. It is a luxury, I would say, to the white people sitting in this room, not to have to think about race every split second of our lives. Privilege is invisible to those who have it. Now remember, I was the only man in this room. So when I heard this, I kind of went, oh. And someone said, well, what was that reaction? And I said, well, when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I see a human being. I'm a generic person. You know, I'm a middle-class white man. I have no race, no class, no gender. I'm universally generalizable. So I like to think that that was the moment I became a middle-class white man. That class and race and gender were not about other people, but they were also about me, and I had to start thinking about them. And it had been privileged, and it kept it invisible to me for so long. Now, I wish I could tell you that this story ends 30 years ago in that little discussion group, but I was reminded of it quite recently. I have a colleague at my university, and she and I both teach the sociology of gender course. So when I teach it, she comes to give a guest lecture for me. When she teaches it, I go to give a guest lecture for her. So I walk into her class, about 300 students. I walk in to give a guest lecture in her class, and one of my students looks up and says, oh, finally, an objective opinion. All that semester, whenever my female colleague opened her mouth, what my students saw was a woman. I mean, CJ, if you were to stand up in front of my students and say, there is structural inequality based on gender in the United States, they would say, well, of course you'd say that. You're a woman. You're biased. When I say it, they go, wow, that's interesting. Is that going to be on the test? How do you spell structural? So let me just put it this way. I hope everybody in the back can see. This is what objectivity looks like. You know, disembodied Western rationality. And that's why, I'm sorry the answer's not here anymore, but that's why I think men wear ties. Because if you are going to embody disembodied Western rationality, you need a signifier. And what could be a better signifier of disembodied Western rationality than a garment that at one end is a noose and the other end points to the genitals? This is mind-body dualism right here. This is it. Now, why is it so important? Because making gender visible to men, which is our first task, understanding that gender matters to us, is simultaneously about privilege. You can't get away from that. The question is, let's make it visible. How did you not know about this for so long? How did you not think this was actually about you to begin with? So making gender visible is about privilege. And the other thing is, I think that there's another element to it. And I, in talking with people at dinner, I heard this kind of escalation in he said, she said, back and forth, kind of acrimony. And I think that there's a reason why so many men sort of don't support gender equality when it's so clearly and obviously the right thing to do. But one of the reasons why, I'll just tell you one more story and then I'll stop. I was on a TV talk show. You've all seen it, no doubt. You know, black female host comes from Chicago. And, you know, we academics don't make very good talk show guests. Because the typical talk show these days is very heated, very polarized. Yes, no, us, them, black, white. And what do academics do? We come on and go, well, it's a little more complicated. You know, which is, let's say, that is bad TV. So, so I was on the show opposite four angry white men. These were men who believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace. They were the victims of affirmative action. They were qualified for jobs, qualified for promotions, they didn't get them, and they were pissed. And so they all told their story about how they were qualified for jobs and promotions, they didn't get them, they were really angry about it. And the reason I'm telling you this story is the title of this particular episode was a quote from one of these men. And the quote was, "A black woman stole my job." So these guys all told their stories, and then it was my turn, and I said, "I have just one question for you guys." And it's a question about the title of the show, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." Actually, it's a question about one word in the title. I want to know about the word "mine." Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why is it the title of the show, "A Black Woman Got the Job," or "A Black Woman Got a Job"? Because without confronting men's sense of entitlement, we'll never understand why so many men resist gender equality. We think this is a level playing field. So any policy that tilts it even a little bit, we think, oh my God, water's rushing uphill, it's reverse discrimination against us. This, and so this is really important. That sense of entitlement. Look, white men in Canada, the United States, and West of Europe are the beneficiaries of the single greatest affirmative action program in the history of the world. It is called the history of the world. So now I think we know what we're up against. The invisibility of gender. Our first task is we have to start raising the question. What does it mean? What does it mean to be a man? It's not just enough to sort of assert those old four rules, but what does it mean? How does it work for us when we're not just sort of being a bro, but when we're being a son and a boyfriend and a father and a friend? What does that mean to us? And secondly, that raising the question of what it means to be a man has to talk about privilege. How did we not see this before? And third, we have to confront that sense of entitlement. And then and only then do I think that will be possible for us to have that kind of conversation with women who have already begun to have that conversation through in their work. So this is, to me, the starting point for the conversation that we have to have among men. Now, what I've argued about Guyland is very simple. This is a permanent stage of development. It is not going to go away. We will not be sitting here talking in 40 years about once upon a time people were getting married in their late 20s and, you know, committing to careers in their late 20s. That's not going to happen. This is here to stay. So the question for us is not how do you avoid Guyland, because there's no avoiding it. It's here. It's a stage of development. The question is that we have got to work together, and everyone, administrators, faculty, students, community at large, we have got to work to raise these kinds of questions to enable young people, particularly in my age, because I study this, young men, to navigate their way through this guideline by understanding it, by looking at it, and we have to enable them to navigate their way through it more consciously and more ethically. Thank you very much.
So due to technical difficulties, we didn't play In Their Shoes before, but we're going to play it right now. Take a listen.
In Their Shoes, my name is Morma Zanke, and I asked students on campus, if you were in a significant figure's position, what would you do in their shoes? This week I asked students, if you were AMS president, what would be the first issue that you would address? This is, of course, relevant because of the ongoing AMS elections that have been happening. Students have been voting all throughout the week. Voting ended at 5 p.m. today when our show started, and the results will be in as News 101 finishes. At the gallery, they will be announcing the winners of the election. So I'm taking this in-between period from the time that voting has ended to the time that we will hear who the AMS president will be as a period of just general awareness, what we would want in our candidates, and whoever it is, you know, hopefully they'll listen to to what students are concerned about and what improvements could be made at UBC. I went around campus and found as many students as I could to answer this question. Perhaps this is one of the most enlightening episodes. Most people are a little bit shy at first when I ask them a question, but this has been the one question that I got the most eager responses from. Perhaps because the event is so eminent and relevant in their day-to-day lives, that I got so many keen responses, but whatever it is, students really wanted to share what they would want to do as AMS president. So to begin, I'd like to kick it off with some health concerns that students had, starting with the catering service at UBC.
My name is Sophie. If I were the president, the first issue I would address is the catering service on campus. I think the choices are really limited for students, especially during rush hours. We have to like wait for in a long line in the sub. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would be my top priority.
I guess like the sports facilities, like the rec. Yeah, like there are always like waiting lines and waiting lists for even lockers, for the gym, for the basketball courts. Yeah, just that. Because that's like pretty much one of I go there like every weekend and stuff, so like it's frustrating if I have to wait.
I'm Louisa. I would change. The first thing I would change would be the smoking on the campus. I believe that there's a lot of smoke in the public areas that are affecting like my commute to class, and I'm always like getting secondhand smoke, which is a something in this environment that I don't want, and I feel like there should be separate areas where it's allowed and not allowed for smokers for the safety and of everybody and the health.
So we had three different points of view there. First, we heard from a young woman who was concerned about catering and eating healthy and how maybe we could have more systems in place to make this process easier. There are huge lineups. Perhaps there's not, you know, a lot of healthy choices. She seems to just want a quick exchange where she can get the food that she wants, just sort of go on throughout her day without having to wait so long. Lineups at the gym, again, from our next speaker. And smoking. Smoking is a concern that was brought up. Just all health issues, improving the general vibe on campus. We all are caring for each other. We're all in this together. We just need, you know, a better system that maybe the AMS president could propose to living healthier lives. Moving on from health concerns at UBC, some students brought up some general building concerns, you know, infrastructure that they thought could improve UBC.
Hi, my name is Lisa Vu, and if I was AMS president, the first issue I would like to address is to build the infrastructure of the school so that we are able to accommodate the needs of disabled students better. Currently, as I'm entering the math annex, I realize that it's not very accessible for students in maybe wheelchairs or crutches, and it makes it difficult for them to go to school. And as a prior student in high school who was on wheelchairs, I found that it's very, very important to be able to have access to maybe an elevator or like a ramp for them to meet the needs. Yeah.
I would like to increase the security of the school because I have been noticing that how a lot of the buildings never have like a security camera. So about what happened before about the rapists and then how the things were happening, a lot of the girls were frightened in the dorm because I live on dorms, and then all of us were kind of scared, although they are safe walk, but still we feel like the rapist is out there and then we're kind of insecure in the night.
These two girls bring up some points that I think are often overlooked. Infrastructure for disabilities and security cameras. You know, the average person might not think about these things as frequently, but that doesn't mean that they aren't just as important as any other issue. Definitely want to make people with disabilities feel like they are at ease. And security cameras, especially right now with these assaults that are happening, really important to make people feel safe on campus. Moving on from specific issues on campus, there are a lot of broader issues on the minds of students.
I'm Julie Vandevalk, and something I would like to change is I would like to bring divestment to UBC, so get our endowment money out of fossil fuel companies.
My name is Margarita Dovgal. I'm a first-year art student, and if I were AMS president, I'd stop UBC divesting its tracks, because I feel that this emphasis on making things green often overlooks the practical approach and the fact that it's not, even though the ultimate aim is to be environmentally sustainable, it's not economically and materially sustainable for UBC to pursue non-fossil fuel invested technologies.
So divestment for UBC with the fossil fuels, this was in a referendum question, and I think that has spurred on a lot of questions and concerns from the UBC community. So you can see there are conflicting ideas based on this, which is why it is so controversial. Students have heated emotions about this. It's the age-old question of environmental versus economical. It's hard to say what is the right thing. It's definitely a personal opinion. And so I think just bringing it up and acknowledging it as a serious issue is all that the AMS president can do. Moving on from fossil fuels, another young man had a topic that he would bring up as AMS president.
My name is Gavin, and if I was AMS president, I guess I've heard there have been some kind of ambiguous budget issues, and those could be looked at, I guess, if I was president, so maybe keep that into consideration.
So, finances, ambiguous in the AMS, something that I think everyone would like to get cleared up, and we have students who have ideas for funding that they think would be worthwhile at UBC.
If I was AMS president, the issue I would address would be lower tuition.
My name is Luvian Wang, and if I were a president, first thing I will do is to reduce the tuition fee. And I think for international students, their tuition fee is too high. And I think their tuition fee is four times more than us.
Probably have more events for the students that are aboard, or to connect the students to the school. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. Some people are new to here, right? Mm-hmm. So it's hard for them to find, because it's awkward, you just ask people to be your, to hold a, I don't know, not a party, but probably a club or something, to talk about if you pass experience and join together, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I think.
I would address first issue, there are two biggest issues, I think. The first one is the Canada line and the 99 connection problem. The 99 isn't a very efficient system. Although I don't take the bus, but sometimes I do. 99, it should be a SkyTrain from Broadway to here. And the other problem is this school, I don't know about other faculties, but for my faculty, which is engineering, the rankings keep going down in the past 2 years. I'm not saying that research is bad. The research at this school is great, but sometimes there's not enough funding for student design teams, student projects, so that should be worked on. That's all.
Of course, we have tuition. I think that's on every student's mind, is to lower tuition, especially international students. And then we had a young girl who commented on making a club for students from abroad where they could meet and interact, which I thought was a really lovely idea. It's important, students are coming from all over the world to UBC, and they're spending a lot of money. They need an environment where they can interact and feel social among each other. And I think that was a really good point made by this girl. And then we had somebody talking about transportation funding, and also funding student projects for research. So there are many ideas for the AMS, where the money can go, what needs to be funded. It's a constant juggle, I suppose, where finances go and what is the best way to use the money given to them, what resources should be promoted. So I think that with that, we can see all of the different perspectives from so many students as to what they would do if they were AMS president. We heard about health, catering, the gym, issues regarding smoking. We heard students talking about infrastructure changes for students with disabilities, security cameras, and then major problems like the fossil fuels and just all of these issues that students are really hammering home. There's just such a variety of things that could be changed and what issues need to be addressed. And I think that this is a good kind of sample of what it is the students need at UBC. And I really hope that the AMS president, whoever that is, will listen to these and try to incorporate, you know, what the student body really desires into their platform and be a really good representative of the Thunderbirds. This has been the sixth episode of In Their Shoes. Thanks so much for listening and have a great night.
So that was Mormay with her episode of In Their Shoes. Next up, we have Max Nominacker's interview with SFU's Professor Andrew Feenberg about how technologies such as MOOCs change education.
Have you ever taken a MOOC? Massive open online courses are classes that you can take on the internet. In the last years, a lot of universities have put up those courses on a whole range of different subjects. I talked to Andrew Feenberg, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Philosophy of Technology in the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, about changes in education through technology. Already in the 1980s, he set up the first online education program in the world in La Jolla in California. Professor Feenberg, what was it like to start an online education program in the 80s?
It was very hard to launch this program because no one understood what we were talking about. You have to remember that in 1981, 1982, when we gave the first classes, typing was women's work. And the people, I mean, the equipment we were giving people cost a lot of money. We charged tuition because we had a lot of expenses. This was a program for people in high positions in corporations and government, which by definition means men who did not type. And we were presenting them with keyboards. So, you know, people think, the computer is this high-tech thing, it's all very advanced and so on. But actually, our biggest problem was the keyboard. So it was possible, though, to recruit people. We had, I think there were more teachers than students in the beginning. But gradually, the program developed and became a kind of model, and it was much discussed. There were articles about it in the New York Times and Fortune magazine and many other.
What were the courses all about?
We thought that what leaders in business and government needed to learn about was social science, but qualitative social science. In other words, understand better things that were happening in the world around them that were still perhaps not on the radar screen, except as little blips, right? Like ecology or problems of international affairs and understanding other cultures. Mm-hmm. One important thing that we did at the time, which seemed like a side issue to most people, was to engage a climatologist in discussion of climate change. So in the early 1980s, we had every few days a short text put on our website about the coming climate change to be expected in the 21st century. So we were a bit ahead of our time. And of course, people were just amused by this or, you know, intrigued, but it didn't occur to them. You couldn't really feel the weight of this issue in 1983, say, the way you do today in 2014.
But basically it was all text and there were no pictures and no audio or anything like that.
At 300 baud?
Yeah.
And then we progressed to 1200 baud before I left. No, it was impossible to deliver audiovisual material with this system. But that doesn't mean we couldn't use the mails. We could send people packets of readings, and those could contain pictures. So we had a kind of hybrid between the old-fashioned distance learning system, which is based exclusively on the mails, and some newer, like internet-based systems, which only use the computer to deliver all the information and all the visuals. So we were at this point where a hybrid was possible, and what we chose to put on the computer system was human interaction, which is missing from traditional distance learning programs.
But how was the interaction between the people? Because they could only see that there's somebody somewhere and he's typing something.
Yeah, of course, that would have been difficult to sell. But these people were influential people with plenty of money, expense accounts, and so on. They could come to La Jolla. And we made them come every 6 months for a week-long face-to-face seminar. And that's where we trained them in the use of the mysterious keyboard and the software, and where they met up and socialized and met the teachers who we also invited. So there was a face-to-face component, as in current blended courses. And I think that was an essential part of the system that we developed. Although I have done courses where the people were unable to meet because they didn't have enough money to fly from all over the world to a single location. And those can work well too. They just don't create as strong a sense of community.
And how is it for the teacher? Because when I'm sitting in a lecture and I'm daydreaming, the prof probably sees it, but if I'm just sitting on my computer, he just sees that I'm there, or if I'm not there, but not how I interact.
This is we call this the problem of lurkers. The lurker. The lurker is someone who's nominally a part of the course, but never does anything. And, of course, in most classroom discussions, there are lurkers, right? Because most people don't talk during a classroom discussion unless the teacher makes them or their teacher is very talented. But still, you can see that they're listening. And so you get some feedback, even from the people who don't speak in a classroom discussion. But online, it's lonely out there. If no one contributes, you don't have a sense that there's any class out there at all. So this was our big problem. How can we promote participation? And remember, these were people who didn't need grades, right? So they had to want to do it. So we had to develop pedagogical techniques that provoked people to respond. We pretty much invented a kind of pedagogy that I think now is widely recognized as a good pedagogy, where the teacher provides what you might call topic raisers or, questions, but questions sufficiently elaborated that the students can understand the context. And then the teacher has to respond to the students' comments, especially if no one else responds to them, so the students get some signal that what they've contributed is appropriate. Otherwise, they're likely to have doubts and not contribute again. So we had a whole concept of how you do it. This is at the very beginning, it became clear to us how you do it. And still today, I think people who run online classes, at least where the teacher is involved, do something similar.
Do you think that every kind of education is possible to get online?
Well, I've heard of someone teaching choreography online, but I'm not so sure about that. I think most of what we do in the humanities and social sciences and a lot of what's done in science classes can be taught online. But there are things, obviously, there are things that go better when people are in the same room with each other or with the equipment that they have to use. So I wouldn't recommend this as a universal replacement.
This is one of the dangers that a lot of people mention when they talk about this massive open online classes, that it could actually replace the whole idea of the university itself.
They said that about radio. This is an old story. For some reason, craftsmen in every field have been replaced by machines, and some of the last holdouts are universities.